It's time now for some fun with math. I say it like that on purpose as a bit of a test. If you cringe when people talk about math or, God forbid, fun with math, you're not alone. But our guest this hour points out how important it is to temper the fear with the knowledge that you need to understand numbers. Just as literacy is extremely helpful in navigating society, numeracy, facility with numbers, smooths a person's way through the world. Ellen Peters writes about it and the lack of it in her book, Innumeracy in the Wild, Misunderstanding and Misusing Numbers. Ellen Peters is a professor at the University of Oregon and the director of the Center for Science Communication Research, commonly abbreviated SCR, and all about helping scientists make their findings clear to the world at large. This is Ellen's third visit to the Exchange this year, so welcome to your hat trick.
Hey, thanks for having me again, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure.
It always is a pleasure to have you here. You know, I made a face when I read the opening remarks in your book about innumeracy just because it was rather shockingly high. How common is it?
Yeah, so innumeracy actually is shockingly high. About a third of American adults don't have the numeric skills that they need to make effective decisions about their health and finances. In fact, about 29% of U.S. adults can do only these very simple processes with numbers, like counting and sorting and using very simple arithmetic.
All right. So then where is the line? I mean, lots of us can do the basic arithmetic you're talking about, but where is the line for considering people to be innumerate?
You know, I mean, that's a judgment call. Basically, people differ quite a bit in their numeric ability, and we can go ahead and categorize people. The way that I would think about categorizing them is based on things that we'd like for them to be able to do. And so, for example, to go even beyond that 29% of the population, you can think of about 62% of our adult population who can't do some tasks that I think a lot of us think that most people can do in health. So, for example, if you're thinking about choosing a health plan, about 62% of our population can't estimate the total annual cost for a health plan, including all that stuff around health plans, the premiums, the copays, the deductibles. They're not able to estimate the total annual cost for a health plan for themselves based on what they expect their health care needs to be. And so you can even kind of call that 62% of our adult population to be innumerate with respect to that task. If you go back to the 29% of the population, the people who really have trouble with a lot of even very simple numbers, anything that just goes beyond simple arithmetic, they won't be able to do. So they often won't be able to identify and use numbers, even in fairly simple tables, for example, to make a choice about a health plan or to do something within a financial realm.
And which way are the numbers moving? I was about to ask about checkbooks, and then I remembered that, it seems like a lot of people don't even bother to keep their receipts when they check out ahead of me. And I'm thinking, wow, with the way I keep my checkbook, I got to have those receipts handy.
Yeah, so I didn't quite understand your question.
Are people balancing their checkbooks less these days and just taking the bank's word for it, for example?
Oh, good question. You know, I actually don't know that. I can tell you that balancing the checkbook would be beyond that 29% of U.S. adults probably would not be able to adequately balance the checkbook. And at that point, I would guess that they probably don't save the receipts because they won't know what to do with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly why the question came. Okay, well, one more avenue of research that I provided for you. You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks.
So it's not just about the way individuals use numbers, though. There's a yikes example from the BBC about twisting contraception numbers around that you provide.
Oh yeah, so the BBC. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but the BBC interpreted the use of a contraceptive in a way that was actually incorrect, and so they took a correct number. But then the way that they presented it out to the world was actually incorrect. Do you happen to have the exact quote?
I don't. If I recall what it was something along the lines of a quarter of the women who seek abortion do so because contraception failed. And I think they got flipped around to something like a quarter of all contraception fails.
Exactly. It was exactly something like that. And it's those things where if you're not very careful with numbers, you can completely change the meaning of the number because it's not that a quarter of all contraception fails. Contraceptive devices are quite reliable. They work really well, but it just happened to they just kind of slightly changed the language and they completely changed the meaning of the numbers as a result.
That's a really interesting realm, though, and I wonder how much you've looked into that, too, the idea of how numbers and letters work together, because it, just the addition or subtraction of a couple of words make a huge difference in the meaning of the numbers in there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can look at, so there's a really simple example that can come up across lots of different domains, but it's particularly relevant in health. You can talk about 90% of patients survive a treatment, or you can talk about 10% of patients die from the same treatment. The numbers are exactly the same. If 90% live, then 10% must die. That just is sort of how the math works. What ends up happening with that kind of a framing effect, depending upon whether you frame it in the positive way or the negative way, it actually makes a big difference to how people end up reacting to the treatment. So if you describe that treatment as 90% of patients survive, people like that treatment a lot more than if you describe it as 10%, that 10% will perish. It's the same number, but just that simple framing, we respond to that framing and don't think about, and often don't think about how to translate the number from the 90% survive to the 10% die.
Wow. So it's just a matter of how it is approached, how it's, the subject is delivered in the first place. You know, I just need to warn you, 10% of the people get this operation die.
Exactly. There are other descriptions that can mislead us, too. So you can present a risk, for example, as a frequency, that 10 out of 100 people will have something happen. Mm-hmm. Or you can present it as a percent. 10% of those same 100 people will have something happen. And let's imagine it's about some scary outcome. Let's imagine it's COVID-19, for example. If you present the exact same number as a frequency, 10 out of 100 adults will get COVID, or you present it as the percentage, 10% out of people will get COVID. But that 10 out of 100 ends up being scarier to people because they can imagine themselves being one of those 10 people. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say the percentage seems more abstract. I'll pick it up on the other side of a break. Ellen Peters is our guest. Her book is Innumeracy in the Wild, Misunderstanding and Misusing Numbers. We'll come back and try to use the right numbers when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. So what I was driving at before the break was about if it's more abstract as a percentage, if you say, you know, 20% of people get this condition versus saying 1 in 5, does the 1 in 5 seem to make it more human, more personal or something?
Yeah, what seems to happen is that people imagine the scary outcome more when it's presented as a frequency. And so you think about, oh my gosh, I might be that one person. And because of that, you end up perceiving more risk from the scary outcome and you end up being, and it ends up affecting your actions after that.
Wow. So we have objective numeracy, subjective numeracy, and intuitive number sense. Can you lay out the overviews of those?
Yeah, so what we've been studying in my lab for the last 15 years are these different ways of thinking about how good or bad are people with numbers. And we think about that in exactly those three ways. So objective numeracy has to do with your math skills, things that we can measure based on a math test that you do. So you're going to get, you know, you're either going to get 9 out of 10 correct or you're going to get 1 out of 10 correct. And the people who get 9 out of 10 correct on that math test are the people we consider more objectively numerate. But then there are these two other really interesting ways of being good or bad with numbers. You can be high in subjective numeracy or low in subjective numeracy. And what that means is that you think that you're good or bad with numbers. So someone who's high in subjective numeracy will say things like, well, you know, I'm really good at working with fractions, or I'm really good at calculating a 15% tip at a restaurant. And the people who agree with those statements more, they think they're good at these math tasks, they have more confidence with numbers, and they tend to persist more with numbers. And that kind of persistence can often help them make better decisions because they just work a little harder with decisions with numbers in their lives. And then the third type of numeric competency is actually quite different. So the third type of numeric competency comes from our evolutionary background. It's the idea that we have these intuitive representations of numbers. We have this sense of how big or small is this number. And if you can sense how big or small numbers are better than other people, you actually remember numbers better, and you can more quickly tell in a decision, well, this one's better because this one's a little bit bigger. People who have a less intuitive sense of the numbers end up not remembering numbers as well, and they tend to not they tend to not be able to tell as quickly in decisions whether one number is bigger than another. And that speed that you can tell numbers apart can actually facilitate decision making.
So is there is intuitive number sense, is that common to more animals than just humans?
Oh, absolutely. So this is, it's actually a really cool, it's a really cool ability that we share across species. So animals from beluga whales to ravens to different kinds of frogs and dogs and different kinds of primates all share this intuitive number sense. And I can give you an example if you'd like one.
Sure.
If you think about that, there was a study done with beluga whales. And beluga whales, I remember from childhood, so they're one of my favorite whales for whatever reason. But beluga whales, if you put something like six fish in one bowl, in one bucket, excuse me, and you put only three fish in a different bucket, and you give them the choice of which bucket to go and eat from, and they're only allowed to eat from one, and you've trained them ahead of time, so they know that, they will actually, for the most part, they'll actually beeline towards that bucket with more fish as if they were able to count. Now, they're not really able to count, but they're able to sense that, well, six is bigger than three, and I want more, not less food. And that same kind of number sense can end up guiding guiding frogs to what mate they want, because the mate is stronger. They can make more sounds than another frog. It ends up guiding humans really quickly, even to know things like, well, that income is higher than that income. So in a lot of ways, in at least that sense, that job is better. And it's that really cool intuitive sense of number that can just provide this quick and dirty judgment.
I wonder, Ellen, what kind of challenges the different levels of numeracy presented in trying to craft this book, because you're trying to talk to people about numbers, and I can understand how some people might go, huh, forget it, I can't even follow this.
Yeah, well, hopefully they are able to follow it. Mm-hmm. So the way that the book is set up is we talk first about what we have the most research on. So most of the research that exists out there has to do with objective numeracy, people's math skills, and how that those math skills or lack of math skills make a difference to how you process information out in the world and ultimately how you judge and decide. And then the other two number senses, we're just starting to get a feel now for how they end up affecting decision-making. So the intuitive number sense, for example, that I mentioned a minute ago, another thing that intuitive number sense does is it actually seems to help lay the foundation for math skills, so that children who have more precise intuitive number sense actually end up learning more math than children who have a less precise number sense. So that's one way that the different numeric competencies or abilities end up interacting, and there are other ways as well.
Ellen Peters is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is Innumeracy in the Wild: Misunderstanding and Misusing Numbers. Let's talk about then the objectively enumerate in the first section of the book, and particularly with assessing risks and benefits. If you're less numerate, in the example you gave about trying to figure out a health plan, what do you fall back on?
Yeah, so people who are less numerate, the numbers, of course, are just simply harder for them. And what they end up doing is they end up using other information that's just easy for them to evaluate. And the stuff that ends up being really easy for us to evaluate in decisions are things like our own emotional reactions. And that might be an emotional reaction to something like a scary outcome in a health setting. Or it might be a positive emotional reaction, like to a financial opportunity. And so people who are less numerate tend to be more swayed by those kind of emotional reactions. They're also just more swayed by a compelling story. So someone who's less numerate is more likely to be vulnerable to the power of a compelling story, like in finances, the neighbor who struck it rich because they won the lottery. And someone who's less numerate might be vulnerable to that story, and they might go out and buy lottery tickets, despite the fact that the statistics show that you're incredibly unlikely to win big in the lottery. And in fact, overall, if you continue to play, you're just going to lose money over time, on average.
So let's bring in Daniel Kahneman and heuristics. Give us a sketch of what he means by that.
Yeah, so heuristics are these cognitive shortcuts that people take when they're making judgments and making choices. And Danny Kahneman is a psychologist who's currently at Princeton, and he wrote a recent book, Thinking Fast and Slow, where he went over a lot of these cognitive shortcuts that we take in making decisions. So as an example, one cognitive shortcut we take has to do with that power of compelling stories. So we tend to rely more on things like what he would call the availability heuristic. So when a story is very available to you in the moment, and that, you know, if you go back to the 70s, that would be like shark attacks from the movie Jaws. You know, I have to say I grew up during that mm-hmm. decade, and anytime I think about sharks, I hear the Jaws music. Yeah, you just can't help it. It just automatically kind of goes off in your head. And that availability of information over time ended up making people's risk perceptions for shark attacks go way up. People think shark attacks are much more dangerous than they really are. Something like malaria and the mosquitoes that spread malaria cause much more death and destruction than, like, way, way more death than sharks do. And yet, just that power of Jaws and the music from that movie was simply really powerful.
Wow, that's given me almost beyond the emotional level too. It's just sort of in some sort of, you know, limbic brain level too. You hear the music and go, oh, shark.
Exactly.
Amazing connection. So let's talk, what is the hospital problem that Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky use?
Yeah, so the hospital problem has to do with what's called the representativeness heuristic. And it's the idea that if you tell people about two hospitals, there's one large hospital and one small hospital, and you simply ask people in which of these two hospitals is it more likely that 50% of the infants born will be male and 50% will be female? And again, there's one large hospital, so lots of babies are born in the large hospital, and there's one small hospital, so only, you know, a small number of babies are born in that hospital. And based on the representativeness heuristic, when you think about the representative 50% of on average across all babies are male, people think that they're equally likely in the two hospitals. So the likelihood of a male is equal in the two hospitals based on people's perception. And that's on any given day.
Mm-hmm.
What actually happens, though, when you have a very large hospital can take advantage of the large numbers. And in that hospital, the likelihood that a male baby is born is about 50% because there's lots and lots of babies born. But with the small hospital, that's actually not as true because you get variation in the numbers from day to day. If you looked across 5 years, that 50% likelihood of a male baby is probably true in the small hospital. But on any given day, it might be that all the babies are male, or it might be that none of them are male.
Wow. So it really is about choosing the period and the space. And you know, you got space and time and all sorts of other considerations to take your samples from to consider here. So this is the stuff we can think about when we're a little more facile with numbers. Exactly the point of Ellen Peters' book, Innumeracy in the Wild, Misunderstanding and Misusing Numbers. Ellen is at the University of Oregon, where she runs the Center for Science Communication Research. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. No fear of math here. We have three phone calls waiting. Here's Mark and Merlin. Welcome to the exchange.
Good morning. I'm wondering if your book goes into something. I find myself often in between things of trying to take, as a scientist, trying to take basic data and putting it into patterns that I can use and recognize to come up with some hypotheses for. One of the things that I can remember doing was looking at when we were learning statistics, looking at bell graphs and seeing how many clusters of anomalies had to come up before the shape of bell graphs actually would change for us. And so one of the things I'm wondering is there something in your book that sort of makes this bridge between those of us that are semi-literate when it comes to, you know, plugging in stuff to come up with algorithms, so that we can sort of refer to this and say, oh, well, that's what that means, instead of, you know, sort of being in a fog.
All right. Thanks for the question, Mark. Appreciate it. Ellen, thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Mark, first, I am super impressed that you're actually doing this. You're thinking about this idea that how you present numbers ends up influencing how you end up evaluating them, what you end up seeing in the data or not seeing in the data. And those are really, really important things to think about, particularly when you're trying to understand data yourself or you're trying to communicate that data to somebody else. And in the book, starting at about chapter 15, I have several chapters that look at exactly this question about how do you present data so that people can understand it better, but they can also draw more meaning from it and they can see patterns. And there's a variety of things that you can do. I'm not sure about your exact problem and exactly how I would do it. But part of what you want to do is you first want to think about actually providing that numeric information as opposed to not providing it, because that does make a difference to what you end up seeing and what other people end up seeing, as opposed to just providing words, for example.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to say more people do this than they would do that. You want to be real as specific as possible.
And you even want to say 72% of people do this compared to 28% who don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually want to use the numbers themselves. The other thing is oftentimes data are just a swamp of data. There's just too much there. And sometimes what you have to do is you have to take a small slice of the data. You want to reduce the cognitive effort that's required to try to draw meaning. And so you, at least in the moment, you look at fewer options or you provide less information. There are other simple tricks you can use. This one sometimes ends up surprising people. Even particularly people who are more numerate, you want to keep what's called the denominator the same. And so a denominator is something like if I tell you there's a 1 out of 100 risk, or I tell you that there's a 1 out of 50 risk. There, the out of 100 and the out of 50, those are two different denominators, and it makes it hard for people to compare the numbers. And so instead what you can say is you can say 1 out of 100 and versus 2 out of 100. And then keeping that denominator constant, keeping it always as out of 100, makes it much simpler to see the patterns in the data, even for people who are highly numerate sometimes. Because, again, sometimes we're given just this swamp of data.
Mark, thanks for the question and thanks for the efforts. So do you find, it seems like in media this gets done a lot, though, where the denominators change or just the scales change, you know, where you get, well, 3 out of 5 Americans feel this and the next chart is go, but 47% feel this.
Yeah, and it makes it really, really difficult for people, especially for people who are less objectively numerate, who aren't as good at math, but it also matters for people who are good at math. I had the opportunity one time to sit in on some genetic counseling appointments here in Eugene that the patients gave their permission, and the genetic counselor wanted me there to kind of give her advice on, can I do something better here so that my patients understand what I'm telling them better? Because it's really, really important. And one of the things that I noticed as she was going through this appointment was exactly what you were talking about, Jeffrey. She was changing the denominator. So she would talk about, your risk is 1 out of 250, but if you do this, the risk goes down to 1 out of 50. And I was watching the patient's face as she was saying that, and at first the patient was listening, and then her eyes just started to gloss over as the counselor continued talking and continued switching denominators. So we had this nice long chat about it. I had a nice long chat about it with the counselor afterwards, and then ran into her about 6 months later, and she'd actually taken my advice to start to keep denominators the same. And anecdotally, at least, she thought it made a huge difference.
Wow, so a chance to really look at things side by side and say, okay, I'm looking at, apples and apples here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a great way of putting it.
So talk about examples where people try to use stories or examples. Senator Jim Emhoff and his snowball on the Senate floor, for example. What do you see the problem is there?
Yeah, so Senator Jim Emhoff threw a snowball on the Senate floor at one point as a way of saying that that climate change that global warming wasn't happening. Because, how can global warming be happening if there's a snowball. It came down from the sky. It's not warm at all. And the problem is that the idea of global warming has to do with numbers. It has to do with statistics. And it has to do with looking at these trends over time as the global temperature has been increasing over years and years at this point. That doesn't mean snowballs can't happen. It just simply means that the that the Earth's temperature is starting to rise slightly, but it's starting to rise slightly in a way that's causing climate chaos for us. And so, in fact, some areas will actually get colder, where other areas are going to get quite a bit warmer, and it's going to throw the world into mayhem.
Yeah, when you look at a bunch of different number sets, it all begins to make a lot more sense, which does require a little more than just having a snowball in your hand on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Again, the example there from Senator Jim Inhofe, presented in the book by Ellen Peters, Innumeracy in the Wild, Misunderstanding and Misusing Numbers. We'll come back and take some more phone calls and talk more with Ellen Peters when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. We're talking about how people who are not very numerate, who are not terribly good with numbers, do tend to fall back on stories or emotional stories. Is there a correlation that's been found so far between level of numeracy and level of emotion used in decision making?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You can see that in a variety of different studies where people who are less numerate use those emotional reactions more. And that, for example, seems to explain the higher risk perception that we talked about earlier in the show.
I haven't asked about how info is presented. I mean, does it make a difference to the less numerate if it's presented orally or written or in pictures, or does this differ from person to person?
So it probably differs some from person to person, but there's also that same kind of correlation with numeracy. So people who are less numerate, they're more likely to respond to stories and they're less likely to respond to numbers. But if you take those numbers and present them in a more pictorial form, something that we might call a pictograph or an icon array, the people who are less numerate are actually better able to understand the numbers. And in a pictograph is something you can imagine that if there's a 9% risk, you can either say, well, there's a 9% risk of, you have a 9% risk of a heart attack, let's say. Or if you have a 10 by 10 array of boxes, if you can imagine that, having 10 columns and 10 rows, the other way of presenting that exact same number is you have all those 100 boxes in the 10 columns by 10 rows, and you color in 9 of them, and you tell the person, yeah, that you have a 9% risk, or 9 out of 100 people, just like are in this icon array. And what that does is it helps the people who are less numerate to understand the 9, but also the 91% chance that they're not going to be susceptible to whatever it is.
I wonder, Ellen, if you maintain somewhere in your files, either physical or on the computer someplace, a hall of fame of people who've used numbers graphically well, and a hall of shame of people who've used them really poorly.
Yeah, so we do have some of that, and particularly during the coronavirus, I've been collecting some examples like that. Huh. And so you can see, for example, there was a tweet sent out by Ann Coulter at one point on flu and COVID-19 death rates by age. And she wasn't actually presenting the numbers. She was just interpreting the numbers, but she actually interpreted them incorrectly. And the reason that she interpreted them incorrectly is that the two graphs for the flu and COVID-19 were presented side by side, but the age groupings had changed. And so it was very, even though it was the same number of bars for both the flu and COVID-19, what age group was underlying each of those bars was different, and it made interpretation a lot harder for her.
Well, that's a real big basic, isn't it, when you're looking at charts to make sure that you got the same numbers on the left side and on the bottom?
Yeah, exactly, because people are automatically going to be drawn to just comparing things because it looks like, oh, there's 6 bars here and 6 bars here. I'll just compare the congruent bars. But in that case, that it wasn't possible.
Huh. Let's take another call here. Karen in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ellen Peters, the author of Innumeracy in the Wild. Hi, Karen.
Yeah. I wanted to express that I get so frustrated when I see how the news and the pharmaceutical companies manipulate the population by changing from risk factors to efficacy of a medication.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're at risk and maybe 2 people in 100 are at risk for a disease, and then they take this medication and maybe only 1 person's at risk of the disease, but they present it as a 50% decrease in risk. And it's really manipulative to because people think, oh, gosh, you know, I'm going to have a 50% better chance of survival or whatever. That's what I get frustrated with.
Right. Small numbers equaling big percentages. Good example. Thanks for that, Karen. And how do you deal with that, Ellen?
Yeah, so you don't present it that way is the main way you do that. People do use what's called relative risk, that 50% increase a lot. And they forget that sometimes, and when you present it that way, people forget that the absolute risk difference might not be very big. And like in the case that we just heard about, it certainly wasn't a very big increase. And so what you do is to correct for that, you can present the relative risk, but you also need to present those absolute risks, that change from, I've forgotten the numbers that the caller gave, but that change from, you can say it's a 50% increase, but you also have to be able to present like the 1% risk here and versus the 2% there. So you can present both, and that helps.
Yeah, I've often wondered why particularly news media people seem to get into this. And of course, I can criticize my profession more than any other. But you know, where they indicate, oh, there's a 400% increase. Why don't you just say multiplied by 5?
Yeah, but so I think it attracts attention.
Mm-hmm.
So that 400% increase, that 400 is bigger than 5, and it feels a lot bigger. You know, going back to that idea of the intuitive sense of numbers that mm-hmm. we have. So a 400% increase feels huge, and it attracts attention probably to headlines. And that may be why they're choosing to do it. I mean, that's also assuming they're doing it intentionally. I think we often do things like that unintentionally, where we're just not thinking very hard about how we're presenting numbers. And I would just suggest out to people in the media, people who are other kinds of communicators, whether physicians or public health people, that we have a responsibility. If we're communicating numeric information, we have a responsibility to do it mindfully and not mindlessly, and to think about that fact that our caller just talked about, that if you present a relative risk when it's not really that big a difference, that in some ways is not ethical.
Yeah, I must say I pride myself on the fact that one of our pride to the JPR News and the fact that one of the reporters contacted me recently and said, I'm working these numbers and here's what I'm getting. What do you get? And I ran them myself and got the same result. So we at least we're double checking each other.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Let us take another call from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Thanks for a great program. I have sort of an anecdote about myself. I'm an older person, and we didn't get tested for dyslexia and that sort of thing in elementary school, and I was always a slow reader. And we had a good school system. I did all right in math. Until I reached into high school, and I tried to take, for example, speed reading and couldn't speed read, and then I tried to take typing and couldn't get above like 30 to 40 words per minute, and I still had no idea why. And then when I got past geometry, which I greatly loved and got A's in, and got into higher algebra, I realized I didn't comprehend what was happening. And when I got into, so I decided not to do trigonometry and calculus in high school. When I got into college, then I started interacting more with people, and I realized that other people were able to go from A to D instantly, whereas I had to go to A, B, C, D. And I realized that I liked the mechanics of physics, but I had no comprehension of the theoretical of physics, much like the theoretical of calculus or other higher math. So I wondered if there is a correlation between a mild dyslexia and inability to comprehend theoretical aspects of mathematics. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Connie. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, so really interesting question, Connie. I don't know of any data on it, but I could imagine that when you're trying to understand the theoretical aspects of something, that it involves a lot of language. And because of that, those kind of reading skills that you had some difficulty with as a child and maybe now too, could end up making a big difference to your ability to put the ideas together, because it's taking you a little longer to read. And if it's taking you a little longer to read and disentangle the words, it's putting you behind on putting together the concepts. And so I could imagine that there would be a correlation. You see the same kind of things in numbers. You see the same kind of thing with something called dyscalculia. Some children have just a great difficulty with numbers, and it takes them a lot longer to put the numbers together, in a sense. I'm kind of washing over the detail here. But because it takes them longer to put the numbers together, they end up not being able to learn higher-level math as well.
It's funny because Randy had just typed on the screen dyscalculia. He knew exactly where you were going with this before you even mentioned the word. So, yeah, interesting. It's a concept that apparently affects a fair number of people. But I want to make sure that we're clear here that there's room for everyone to eat some humble pie, because it seems like, as you point out in the book, even highly numerate people can be swayed by emotion. And you give an example in the crime and handgun realm.
Yeah, so we did we did a study. I'm not sure so much about emotion, but let's talk about that. So we did a study where we essentially gave people a math problem, essentially, and the math problem had to do with the number of cities that had enacted gun control laws or not, and then of each of those types of cities, whether crime had increased, the number of cities where crime among them where crime had increased versus decreased. And so if you can imagine kind of a 2x2 table where you have crime increasing versus decreasing, and you and then the columns are cities who had enacted gun control laws or not. It's a math problem. It's actually kind of a hard math problem for people. And in fact, even the highly numerate have a really, really hard time with it. If that problem is in a gun control, a very politically divisive kind, very politically divided kind of realm like gun control laws are, what ends up happening is that if the correct answer agrees with you politically, people who are highly numerate are more likely to get it correct. Hmm. But if it disagrees with you, if that correct answer disagrees with what you want to believe politically, people who are highly numerate look just like the less numerate.
Wow, that's a really interesting result there. Let's take another call from John in Mendocino. Welcome to The Exchange with Ellen Peters.
Hi, I'm calling about what I think is a pernicious thing. Medical figures are constantly being manipulated, and they're using these in terms like risk when really probability would be much more accurate. And things like taking a risk that for a person, let's say it's some medical problem, but really only drinkers have the problem, or smokers or something like that, or people who eat too much beef or something like that. But they won't tell you that. They'll thrust the whole, your personal statistic would be much different if you don't do those things, but they don't tell you that. They tell you, oh, your risk is 10%, you know, when really your own personal risk may be zero. And so it gives everyone this idea that they're, oh my goodness, the risk is climbing, you know. And so I think that's part of the reason our health care is so high. It really gets on my nerves. I hear it all the time.
Okay, John, thanks for the perspective. Appreciate that. Ellen, thoughts?
Yeah, so I think that's a really great, actually a couple of really great points you made there, John. But let's take one of them, that idea that there's an average risk across everybody. And that's oftentimes what communicators will give out. Here's the average risk for you of, you can kind of pick the possible serious outcome in your life. But then your personal risk may be quite different. And I always think about that in terms of skydiving. So the average risk of getting hurt from skydiving is probably pretty high, but my personal risk, it is absolutely zero, because you will not find me skydiving on any day.
That makes sense. So you know, a lot of this comes back to health, and so two questions before we go. One is about just one observation actually. You mentioned Medicare in passing, but I have to admit that looking at Medicare supplemental options, and I think I'm pretty good with numbers, but wow, did my eyes glaze over there. So maybe it's a presentational thing too. And then while we're on the subject of health again, what did you find out about physicians and their level of numeracy?
Yeah, so in general, people who are physicians, as you might imagine, they're highly educated, they've had a lot of school, and on average, compared to the general public, they are much more numerate than the general public. But that doesn't mean that they're all really highly numerate, because, in fact, physicians differ quite a bit in numeric ability, too. So there's an example in the book. When medical students answered a numeracy measure, 77% of them were able to answer all three questions correctly. Whereas if you looked at female veterans, only 16% of them were able to answer all three questions correctly on that particular numeracy test. But those physicians differ quite a bit. So when you look at So still that 23% of the medical students were not able to answer all three questions correctly. Their numeracy is simply imperfect.
All right. There's just so much level of detail in the book, but it is well presented, as you would expect from the director of the Center for Science Communication Research at the University of Oregon, Ellen Peters, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about her book, Innumeracy in the Wild, Misunderstanding and Misusing Numbers. Ellen, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us once again.
Yeah, thank you, Jeffrey. Have a great day.
You too. And that'll do it for today's exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers are John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Our student assistant, Randy Babbitt, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. Join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.